We're in an age of everything as a service. If you've got a credit card and an internet connection, you can go in and buy whatever you want. If you have enough money, you can solve any problem that you want. So I think CIOs generally need to become expert orchestrators and capability and service managers.
Welcome to the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast, where IT and digital leaders from around the world talk about their careers, their inspiration, and their vision for the future of digital business. I'm your host, David Wright. The world of digital business is evolving faster than ever, and I want this to be a place where digital business champions create a village to band together and help each other navigate the ever-changing terrain. Disruptive Innovators features conversations with CIOs and digital leaders from around the world, diving into their personal backstory, career, their current role, trends they've been seeing, and their vision for the future, personally, professionally, and otherwise. This podcast is made for people who are seeing how quickly the digital business landscape is evolving. Those who recognize that it takes a village of trusted advisors to navigate this ever-changing terrain. People who enjoy listening to high-level discussions surrounding what it means to be a leader, real-world examples of challenges faced, and industry-specific strategies leveraged to create exceptional business outcomes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.
Good morning, innovators. David Wright here, and I am your host of the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast. And today I am lucky enough to be joined by Paul Smith. Paul, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I know we've been trying for this for a little while, so it's great to have you on. For those of our listeners, Paul, who may not be familiar with your body of work, can you just share a little bit about where you are today?
Yeah, sure. My name is Paul Smith. Hello, everyone. I'm a Chief Information Officer at Amnesty International, who are the largest human rights nonprofit in the world. So my remit here covers things like IT operations, portfolio and change delivery, information security, information management, enterprise architecture, enterprise business systems, and tech engagement. So quite a good, interesting team I have here.
Yeah, and I've admired the work you guys do at Amnesty for so long. One of the reasons I was so excited that our teams hooked us up, and I've been a donor for, I think I got a little monthly donation to Amnesty. Yeah, of course, it's great work. Paul, I want to definitely dive more into the work you guys are doing at Amnesty. But before we do, want to hear a little bit about your background. And even prior to that, we like to start the episode with just one piece of actionable advice you might look to leave everyone with today.
I think that's great. And I think it's the one piece of actionable advice I could leave you all with today, being to develop your skills in being resourceful, whatever resourceful means to you, but develop those skills. And I'll explain a little bit why as we get into the conversation.
Boom. Love it. Love the teaser here. So Paul, let's get into it. Let's tell me a little bit about your background, how you started out and how you got to the point that you're at in your career today.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, David. So I guess potted history for me would be I'm from a very humble working class background here in the UK. So I'm in the Midlands. Didn't start out in IT, didn't pursue IT through school, but I decided to invest in myself through some part-time distance learning to move into IT. And at that point, whilst I was working full-time and managing a family at an extremely young age, I was a young dad. So lots of things to juggle. Early on in my career, I was selected for a directorship development program, which then provided me investment both financially through a sponsored MBA program and with the mentoring and in-depth exposure to aspects of an organization I usually wouldn't have any right to get involved in, particularly not at that point in time when IT was very much a cost function at that point. But that led me to start my IT career in defense before I moved through into direct marketing and big data management, and then latterly in the not-for-profit sector, where I obviously am the CIO at Amnesty. We also hold a couple of other advisory roles in other industries to complement that work too and enable me to give back. But I guess the journey was pretty much peppered by lots of personal and professional development. I feel like I've been learning my entire life, and it doesn't look like it's going to stop anytime soon. But also with a damn good dose of support from others and a lot of opportunity along the way, which I've had to be best placed to take advantage of, I think. That's probably the potted history.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the resourcefulness too, like maximizing the opportunities that were afforded to you, which not everyone does, because there's a level of fear and trepidation that comes with stretching. And so I admire that. I would ask, I mean, you mentioned the kind of peppered history. What would you say is one of the most important things that you learned? And you mentioned the personal, professional, that's true for me too, over the course of your journey. And if you could think about what life was like before and after, maybe you could share a little bit about what comes to mind.
Yeah, I guess probably one of the most impactful things I've learned on my career journey so far is that you really can't do anything alone. And I think you've got a sense through those networks for knowledge exchange, for shared learnings, for potential opportunity and risk. And you've got to always seek to ask, who else is like me and what are they doing? What can work here? Being inquisitive. And in that, I would actually say to seek to give before you ask for help. But before that, it was a very lonely journey. It was quite stressful. It was hard work. I had to come up with answers to everything from scratch, learn things myself that I didn't know before I could even get going on the task at hand, and do a heck of a lot of trial and error. But I think after it, I probably have realized the value in cultivating and growing my network, not just my own benefit or opportunities, but where I can help others like me with challenges that they've already encountered, with my learnings and experience, and to share my knowledge. And I think in terms of the benefit to my organization, it enables me to channel the collective experience of the network to bring it to bear in my role for the organization. So it's almost like you get Paul Smith plus 10 other CIOs, you know, you get in that effect, which is a lot of value for money. So I've probably saved myself quite a lot of time and effort in that and just shorten that time to value. And actually, I've made a lot of really good friends along the way, and I hope I've inspired some other people like me. So I'd say that's probably my biggest thing.
Yeah, no, it's huge. And as a striver, especially early on in my career, I just can identify with, I'm going to figure it out, just that kind of driven. And it's useful, right? I think that determination and grit and kind of stick-to-itiveness is part of why I am where I am today. And I came to find for myself that it was also tied to my ego, right? And having that get smashed over time, now I can recognize that the older I get, the less I realize I know. There's an interesting conundrum, because I'm as knowledgeable and as successful as I'll ever be, but just it's the humility in knowing that there is so much more, right? And I love what you're saying about the shared experience, because I think one of the biggest values that I've gotten out of podcasting and live events that we host and is this community of executives that I've become friends with, that I can bring a swath of other executives and share that experience and vice versa. And I've learned so much, and I agree, just that mind share of experience is invaluable, because it's stuff you can't find on Gartner, right?
Absolutely. You got to go over yourself. And you use the word ego there, which I think is the perfect word, right? I mean, you've got to not be afraid to ask and be open to other ideas and experiences and life perceptions. If you can do that, there's a lot of value in it.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I know for me, the time that I can think of that moment in time and it when my ego was smashed, and it was actually tied for me more towards a personal matter even than a professional, but it ended up affecting my professional career so profoundly. Is there a time that you can think of, Paul, that you either had a project fail or some sort of hardship, but ultimately it was the catalyst for a new beginning or a lesson that you learned that was profound? Does anything come to mind?
Yeah, I guess that's one lesson I think I've learned over my career. It's the realization that time itself can be one of the biggest challenges in delivering technology change. And I needed the help from my network to see that through someone else's eyes. What do I mean by that? So when we're working on particular technology changes or projects, I think the problem that you're looking to solve has a specific pain and relevance at a point in time. I think the benefits you're looking to deliver have a specific value and relevance at a specific point in time. Because risk profiles change over time, people change over time too. Their attitudes, their desires, their energy, even who's in what role. So I think managing time as a thing in delivering change, I think is really important. And I needed that network to help me see that and to learn from the experiences of others that maybe been through some of those bigger programs. And they said, this is what I wish I'd have done differently. And that gets us into time to value and delivering value early and all that good stuff as positive benefits. But that's probably the link I'd make between the two.
Yeah, that's profound. And I like to think that we do that, but now I'm thinking about it and I'm like, huh. Like obviously time to value and yes, the quick wins, but like managing to it in the way that you're saying, now I have to take a look at that. It's something that I'll take away from today.
Example I would give, you can do all the right things in terms of setting yourself up to deliver change in an agile or waterfall way. But what if the people change? What if your sponsor moves on? What if your key hero on the project moves on? So these are all things that can change over time. And no amount of planning or early value delivery can help that when the rug's pulled out of you in that way.
Yes, 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 absolutely. And we have definitely dealt with that for sure. So I want to talk more about your role at Amnesty. Before we do, we always just like to ask a favorite book or literary piece, blog, either that you've read recently and are hot on or all time, your choice.
That's a great question. I will put my hands up front out. I'm not a big reader. I learn in other ways, to be honest, but yes. Right now I'm reading a very good buddy of mine's book. It's called Clearly Agile, and it's a leadership guide to agility from my good friend, Giles Lindsay. So I think it's worth a check out. He's a good guy and he knows his stuff.
Yeah, I will definitely check that out. We have a lot of our listeners are into that too, so I'm sure they'll get a lot out of that. So Paul, you've been at Amnesty a little over 3 years, give or take. Talk to me a little bit about your vision for the organization based on the overall mission of Amnesty and maybe some of the key initiatives that you guys are working on right now.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think so my vision is simply to bring to bear the power of information and technology. And I use the word separately, information and technology, to end abuses of human rights globally. And I intend to do that with my team through protecting, enabling, and guiding the employees, volunteers, supporters, Amnesty International, and those we sell through IT. Fundamentally, we're a research and information management organization. That's our core. You know, we follow the research lifecycle. It's what we do when we tackle human rights issues. So it actually stands to reason that the more efficient and effective we can be throughout that information management lifecycle, the more aligned and enabled we will be to meet our strategic goals. And that presents great interest in an opportunity for my area in the information and technology space. So some of the key initiatives that we're focusing on, certainly for the moment and looking forward, are in the globalization of our common services offering. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is specifically to just improve collaboration globally. Common platforms, common systems, single sources of truth, to be able to multiply our people power through better information and knowledge sharing and to channel our capability, but also to harmonize technology in terms of simplification for the end user. So to make the services simple to consume, to enable community-led development and knowledge share on the tools and services that we provide, and to also not least, but to also close the digital divide across the organization. There can be a very big difference, even within our own organization, for the services available to our people, which may not even be technology related. It could be the fact that I don't have sustainable power where I live, which prevents me from consuming those technology services. Or maybe there's some other kind of local regulation which stops me consuming that thing in that way. So globalization of our common services offering is important to us. Moving on from that, we're continually improving our defense in depth on information cybersecurity. I'll talk a little bit more about that in challenges in a moment, actually. We're improving our basic services provision in human resources, information management, and financial services capabilities through the continued focus on people, data, process, and tech. And we've certainly got quite a bit of focus in our research and evidence capability management space at the moment, where we are using both existing and assessing emerging technology to assist us in our value chain. because it's core of what we do. Now, that can look specifically seeing where technology can help us with the identification of relevant research sources, disinformation protection, ingestion of information and data, classification, metadata extraction, correlation, tagging and storage, cleansing, deduplication, cross-checking, obfuscation, enrichment, the list there goes on. Discoverability and searchability for those working on common themes to understand what should I care about in our research evidence repository. And how we summarize that, how we bring out insights and how we analyze the information available to us so it's as accurate as it can be. And even looking to how we can start to produce automatic first draft outputs using tools like large language models. So our focus goes less on creation and more on the QA and the refinement of the process. So there's a lot in that space. Other key areas are around insights and analytics. As a data-driven organization, they expect us to want to increase our maturity there continually to put the right data in our users' hands at the right time for the right reason. And actually, for me, we've got a specific strategic focus on where the rubber hits the road. So that means educating our people to get the best value out of the tech that they have. So to make sure they're supported on our enablement journey to ensure maximum engagement over time and actually return on investment for the tech that we have. So it's not everyone comes to the organization from the same technology background, right? So we want to make sure everyone has a common denominator of support and service and education. And then we look to build on that through communities of interest. Education and engagement is really important for me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a lot. Not an easy task as well, having a presence in. How many different countries are you guys in?
I think the last time I looked, it was 150 countries and territories.
Yeah. The knowledge management conundrum, when you think about people being that spread out in that many different countries, speaking that many different languages, that many different currencies, like cultures, because you have like the X's and O's of the language itself, but then take it a step further and just the way that they approach their day. And it's just,
we value that inclusion and diversity focus, right? But it presents unique challenges and unique opportunities. And we've got to try and find some way to harmonize people's ability to connect and work together on themes of interest.
Yeah. Yeah. Kudos. It's exciting that there's never been a better time with the tools that we have access to now to address some of those items that you had listed, that laundry list of the deduplication and all of that, like indexing, et cetera. I know we're broaching this subject with a number of health systems, for example. They've had their data has been distributed in SharePoint and ServiceNow and Confluence, whatever. And like, how are we kind of reassembling that and indexing that? And there's tools now where we can leverage AI to greatly expedite that process, a process that, you know, for a large health system might have taken us 12 to 18 months. Now we can do in 3 to 6 months, and it's exciting. So I'm excited for you guys. What would you say is, I mean, you touched on it a little bit, some of the biggest challenges that you guys are facing today as an organization?
Yeah, sure. So I think the first one, because it's, I guess it's always high priority for us against, we continue to be a target for nation state actors. We've practically unlimited resources in the cybersecurity space. Oddly, it's a sign we know we're doing a good job if we're upsetting people. They are looking to protect their reputation on the global stage because they're high stakes, right? So we know we can't afford to let up in our resilience and awareness, and we must always stay alert and continue to build our defense in depth and recovery capability, because given what I've just said, it's often a case of when, not if, there's an incident. I think cyber and information security for us is always important, and to recognize the close links between digital safety and physical safety for our people and what they do and where they operate. So that's important for us. I think secondly, I guess it's maintaining momentum against a backdrop of global financial crises, both in terms of people's propensity to give to a nonprofit for the cause, but also in the sustainability of the organization. So helping and working with us in that space and playing our own part is an ongoing challenge. Relatedly, demonstrating continual value for money, services deliveries, a strategic organization, and not a cost center. And lastly, you touched on, I think, a bit earlier, but we have to do all the stuff we do at a point in time, but actually we need to ensure immutability of our research over time. We hold quite a lot of the history of the world's human rights atrocities over the last 60 years in our digital and physical archives, which is a publicly accessible knowledge. We publish a lot of this information. So maintaining that, not just ensuring it's relevant and accurate today, but over a prolonged period of time, is a challenge in itself when things like formats change, people's attitudes to this information change, people's attitude to what's right and what's wrong may change over time. It's an interesting point, but I've got a fantastic archives team that work within my organization to help me do that.
I got to be honest, Paul, it's one of the more interesting kind of organizations that I've had the opportunity to just to speak with, and we're an executive representative from an organization like that, and my wheels are turning. You know, you guys are up to a lot. Are there any best practices? And we've gone through a couple, but any additional best practices that you might recommend to our kind of community in kind of managing a team and in situations like this? Any other that come to mind?
Yeah, I can probably give you three, David, to be honest. My first one is relevant and timely communication, always, with a focus on digital experience management. So for us, that means involving the user early and throughout with a focus on being useful and usable. And I guess associated to that, always having a continual learning mindset. You can learn from anyone about anything. People have a lot of lived experiences, right? Some of which are directly related, some are not. But don't be so close to listen to an opinion and cast it off as just that. And so that's number one. I think number two, I think we touched on it again earlier, but you have to be inclusive in respect to diversity of ideas, specifically in an organization like mine. You have to give people an opportunity to hear about, learn from, and offer contribution. Because that communication happens in the mind of the recipient, not in what you say. It happens in what I hear and how I process it. So that means giving people time and space to go away and maybe come back to you next week if they couldn't offer a suggestion there and then. Or presenting information in lots of different ways through lots of different mediums. And I think lastly is just to have as part of your culture a continued improvement, kind of forward and progression mentality as the norm. So we're always looking for ways to improve because, frankly, necessity is a mother of invention for a nonprofit with limited resources. So we try and embed that in our cultural DNA, and I've got a great bunch of people that, you know what, if they didn't know it, they go out and learn it, and they find out, and they try and solve it. I think as a best practice, we've certainly embedded that into our culture.
Yeah, no, I love that. And those are some really great practical kind of things that we can do to look inward. How about, just curious, any, and we touched on this too, innovative technologies you're leveraging or starting to leverage to support the vision of Amnesty?
Absolutely. I gave you probably quite a verbose list of opportunity in the research and evidence management space a little moment ago. It doesn't take too much imagination to see where some current technologies may help us there, in terms of the artificial intelligence processing of evidence, multimedia evidence, the extraction of data, and the automation of outputs. We're certainly looking right across that spectrum of capabilities with a view to some of the later large language models and AI tools that I'm sure we're all very aware of. But actually, I think it's worth saying that innovation is actually a matter of perspective and perception sometimes. I think it can be just as much about applying the basic technology building blocks in innovative ways to me or to the listener as an individual to solve a business problem. So what do I mean by that? So what's basic to you is, you know, a FTSE organization with almost hundreds of millions in budget, maybe very innovative to me as a small nonprofit, depending where you are in your opportunity journey and what you can typically afford. We do focus on doing the basics well too, frankly, because that can be innovative for us in the way we enable people to work. I think by extension and loosely linked, again, the cyberspace, we're looking to make sure we are as mature and tech-enabled in that space as we can be and as affordable in defense of the organization. We're certainly looking to what we can afford and do in that space too.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up that kind of point about innovation being, or like what I heard is, innovation is, or to me, it's like this creative solution to a problem. It doesn't automatically mean technology. And I think you touched on that. And a good example I like to give is, not to harp on healthcare, but we had another health system that people were getting lost. It's this huge hospital, and they had looked into wayfinding, but they couldn't afford it. And so a lot of folks at that point would just throw up their hands and be like, this is what it is for now, right? And they developed this system of like arrows on the ceiling where it guided you where you needed to go. And it improved patient experience dramatically. And it cost however many pieces of paper they used to put those arrows on the ceiling, right? So it just goes to show you, right, that slight shift can make just a world of difference, right? So a few more questions for you, Paul. One would be, where do you see kind of the nonprofit research? You guys are fairly unique, your industry, if you will, but where do you see things going in the future for Amnesty and organizations like it? Or what do you think will be some of the biggest changes as time passes?
It's a really great question. I think in part, my answer is probably relevant to any CIO role anyway, because there's a percentage of IT that is IT is IT, right? And then there's a bit that's relevant to Amnesty. So on reflection with that, I think my first thing would probably be to say we're in an age of everything is a service. If you've got a credit card and an internet connection, you can go in and buy whatever you want. If you have enough money, you can solve any problem that you want. So I think CIOs generally need to become expert orchestrators and capability and service managers. You can go and get what you need, but how do we bring that together? How do we stitch it together? And how do we make it relevant for this organization's problem and to make it stick for our users? So I think that's important. And within that, CIOs are going to become connectors of people. And connectors of things and connectors of people to things. So we're becoming ecosystem leaders. And that's certainly what I'm starting to see here at Amnesty. Because there is an ecosystem at play here, not just people, but things and technologies and processes that makes up the digital brand of your organization. But I think it's been said a few other times that business strategy is technology strategy. More and more CEOs are becoming leaders of organizations, sources and catalysts of critical strategic change. They're the people that boards are looking to move the needle in significant ways. When there's an issue, when there's a big risk, I'd go to the technology guy in the room, the wrong way. We're not subservient cost centers anymore and back office support functions. So I think leaders in our space are specifically look more to you for that competitive advantage and to drive growth through the application of data and technology and through partnerships. So I think digital data and tech leaders need to be people and strategy people, not tech people. And I think loosely linked to that, I think we need to become expert disruption managers. So we've seen in the last 18, 24 months what happens when the latest cool thing hits the market, right? But high-speed digital data and tech disruptions is the norm now. Case in point with those large language models. So they can be triggers for change or to need to do something different that changes your plans. That disruption can be positive in a sense of an innovation or an opportunity or for an external or an internal trigger. Or it can be negative in the sense of a risk or an incident or an unplanned event. Again, that can be internal or external. So your ability to spot, sense, catch these things, do something with them, and quickly impact assess them and understand, do I need to pivot here or change course for the organization? Do I need to grasp that opportunity or change course to avoid that risk? I think is really important skill for any business leader, actually, not just a CIO. But I'm seeing each of these streams really come into sharp focus, even in my role here in the nonprofit space.
Yeah. Oh, great, great insights. You said a lot there, Paul. One thing that I take away from that is how am I creating a culture of innovation, right? How am I fostering an environment where my people aren't afraid to fail fast, integrate feedback, keep it moving? I think for someone like yourself, who's clearly a proponent of that, it looks easy or not. I don't want to say it looks easy, but like, there's just a lot of organizations where it's going to take a lot of work to get there and this type of come from. And the other thing that I think dovetails nicely into that I heard too, is like, how am I being that business leader, right? Not just the classic siloed IT support function and being that leader of the business. How am I going really wide in the organization to understand the viewpoints of the different stakeholders and enroll them in what we're doing? Because in my experience, so often you know, if we're all working at an organization, and especially like Amnesty, right? There's a reason you agree to work with an organization like Amnesty, right? So even if there's certain, and most nonprofits, even if there are certain dissenters in the variation of their opinion, or they may think they have a unique kind of viewpoint on something, it's my job to hear that, understand that, and show everyone how it's all like we could acknowledge that and you can be special and this is how we're going to weave it all together. I think as technologists today, it's more important than ever to be able to step out of my comfort zone and go have those conversations and enroll those people. If God forbid they feel put on, right? And it's just not going to be successful, right?
I think fundamentally the recognition that disruption, innovation, risk, change can come from anywhere. If you imagine you're on a ship and you're looking down at your radar display, things are going to go blip on that radar display. They may be close, they may be far out, but you need to be set up to be able to sense that stuff and know what to do with it, whether it's a great idea or whatever. So I think one thing is there's something there as a digital and tech leader today to make sure you understand that those things can come from internally, externally, through partners, through the industry you work in, and how you spot them, do something with them, engage with those individuals, I think is actually a core competence for an organization, far and above a tech leadership role.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Paul, this has been awesome. Really appreciate you taking the time today. Last question I always like to ask my guests is just if you could go back 5, 10, even 15 years in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
Do you know what? That's a really tough question for me because I've learned a lot along the way and I've got a lot of scars. But if I keep it professional, I think I'd say get out of the comfort zone more often. So for me, that means doing more of this, do more interviews, podcasts, keynote speeches, roundtables, networking events, making the effort to share because actually people will reciprocate. People appreciate it. You don't know who's on the same journey as you until you start talking to people. And you will be surprised who you can help. And I wish I started that a little bit sooner because I've seen such a massive benefit of doing it ever since. And as I said, I've met some fantastic friends, lifelong friends. So I wish I started sooner.
Feeling is mutual. Absolutely. We are where we are based on our experiences. And I admire where you are for sure, Paul. Thank you again so much for being on today.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me, David.
And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you all next week.
Thank you for listening to the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future episodes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.